Last week, Bill McClellan wrote a column about futilely trying to help his daughter write a script for a for a school video project. The way he tells it, she keeps turning him down and telling him everything he writes sounds like a newspaper column. McClellan admits that's true, and he goes on to poke a lot of fun at himself. Towards the end of the column, he mentions, just incidentally, that his daughter's school video won first prize in a statewide contest. Now, one of the first laws of column writing is that people get sick real fast of the columnist bragging about his kids. But McClellan gets away with it. He knows he can say almost anything, including that Hillary Clinton hangs out at the Missouri Bar and Grill and calls him Sailor, if he does it in a self-deprecating way. McClellan gets away with a lot because of that, because he always seems to need a haircut, wears clashing shirts and ties, and claims he writes a newspaper column because he's not fit for real work. But McClellan's humble shtick, like all the best shticks, is based in truth. He really is a humble guy. Bill comes by his humility naturally. He grew up in Chicago rooting for the Cubs. Flunked out of the University of Illinois, served as an enlisted man in the only war the United States has ever lost or admits to losing, and was hired at the Post-Dispatch to write listings for the old calendar section. In 1983, thank goodness he began writing a column, and he's been doing it ever since. Here's Bill McClellan.
Thanks, and just to correct Harper, I dropped out right before I would have flunked out. I mean, it was about 2 weeks before the final grades, and flunking out seemed like such a disgrace. Dropping out seemed to have a certain panache to it, so I dropped out. I will read a couple of columns, and since Hart mentioned Hillary, and since it looks like almost certainly she's not going to be indicted, I thought in honor of her, I'd read a column I wrote in Chicago during the last convention, 1996, when Bill Clinton was renominated. So it's got a Chicago dateline. I was sitting at the bar in a little joint on Wabash Avenue right under the elevated tracks. Now and then a train would thunder past and the television screen at the end of the bar would go fuzzy. Didn't matter to me. The president was giving his acceptance speech, and had I wanted to hear it, I could have used my press credentials to get into the convention hall. Instead, I had come to this joint. It's a place from out of my past. I was on my third whiskey and water. I've done too much drinking this week, when I heard the voice behind me. Hello, sailor. I had known that if she wanted to find me, this was the place she'd come. We used to have lunch here that summer we met so many years ago. I had been working at a small haberdashery on State Street when she came in to buy something for her father. Are you going to ask me to sit down, she said. Sure, sit down, Hillary, I said. She was wearing a wig and dark glasses, but truth is, she didn't need much of a disguise in this establishment. Most of the clientele here wouldn't even recognize her husband. I thought you were at the hall, I said. In fact, a couple of minutes ago, I thought I saw you on television. Computer-enhanced hologram, she said. Don't tell me you're not hip to that. You're not one of those people who think we really landed a man on the moon, are you? You've got a lot of faults, but naivety didn't used to be one of them. She ordered a club soda with a dash of lime. I asked the bartender to touch up my drink. He splashed some more whiskey into my glass. Hillary gave me a disapproving look. I ignored it. Oh, come on, I said. There's worse things than having a drink. Just ask your friend Dick Morris. He's a Republican, she hissed. I almost pointed out that she was a Goldwater girl when I knew her, but I stopped myself. He might be a Republican, I said, but he's acting a lot like a Democrat. It's true, too. In the old days, before party lines got blurred, you generally needed an accountant to catch a Republican. With the Democrats, an eye at the keyhole was good enough. They were a lustier group. You're in a nice mood, she said sarcastically. I thought you'd be happy to see me. I apologized. This has been a difficult week for me. Fun but difficult. Mostly there have been the memories of what might have been. Democratic conventions in Chicago can do that to me. I'm talking about what could have happened in 1864. The Democrats had a convention in Chicago that year, too. They nominated the great George McClellan. History buffs will tell you he lost the general election to Abe Lincoln, the Republican incumbent. Had there only been television in those days, the results would have been different. George was a handsome fellow, thick eyebrows that grew together, long sideburns, a full mustache. The camera would have loved him. But there was no television, and George got crushed. The family never recovered. It was, we like to say, our high water mark, and we've been on the skids ever since. Now it has come to this. In the very town where my ancestor got the party's nomination, I can't even get an invitation to the best parties. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. Jimmy Carter didn't even get an invitation to the convention until it was embarrassingly late. He ended up skipping the whole thing. Short memory these Democrats have. Speaking of parties, Hillary had one Wednesday afternoon at the Billy Goat Tavern on Lower Michigan Avenue. That's a newspaper hangout, and I've been spending a good deal of time there. But when Hillary had her party, they chased out the regulars to let the swells in. Back when George Bush was president, he had lunch at the Billy Goat, and the regulars were allowed in. Now the Democrats are chasing the regulars out. Back in 1864, the Democrats were the party of the people. I read about your party at the Billy Goat, I said pointedly. Ernie Banks was there, she said. So was Sarah Paretsky. Paretsky, of course, the author who writes the V.I. Warshawski Private Eye books. Oh, yeah, Paretsky, I said. If you were inviting authors, you might have thought about me. Seriously, you wrote a book? True crime, I said, paperback. Came out a couple of years ago. She shrugged dismissively as if to say she doesn't read true crime books. I told her I hadn't read her book either. Having exhausted our literary conversation, we turned toward the television. Her husband was saying something to the effect that our best days are still in front of us. The train thundered past and his words were drowned out and his image flickered. So what do you think our chances are in November, she asked me. You guys will win going away, I said. This Morris thing won't change anything. Your husband is a great talker and he'll demolish Dole in the debates. She smiled. I've got a question for you, Hillary. Back in St. Louis, we're pondering the future of Dick Gephardt, but all the so-called informed sources say your husband's going to throw his full support to Al Gore. What's the truth? She hesitated for a moment. Maybe the country will be ready for the first woman president, she said. You mean you? I asked. She shrugged. On the television, the realistic-looking hologram was applauding. Okay. Okay, let's, looking for one here. Hey, Harp, when I read once here before, and did I read the column about when Mary went to Boston and? Oh, okay, well, I didn't read this one then. Let me. Oh, okay, good. Well, this is a different one then. I've written so many, I hate to repeat myself if I only appear twice. You know. Oh, okay. This is a column I wrote several years ago when my wife was going to Boston for a class once a month for the full weekend. And at the time, my children were very small. The North Vietnamese Army likes to attack at night. And with two battalions of the NVA hunkered down in the hills just above my bed, geez, I wished I'd set up on the high ground. You can be sure I slept uneasily Wednesday night. The first attack came shortly after midnight. I threw off my covers and grabbed my rifle. Actually, I grabbed a bottle of formula and rushed into the children's bedroom. My 8-month-old son, Jack, had started to cry. In my fantasy world, Jack represented one of the enemy battalions. My daughter, Lorna, represented the other. When my wife leaves town, which she does for a couple of days each month, I resort to a fantasy life to make my task easier. I pretend I'm a rifle company under siege. When my wife returns, she represents a Marine regiment. I celebrate. The reinforcements are here. The siege has lifted, I shout when she walks in the door. The children scream too, happily unaware that in my fantasy world, they represent the enemy. But back to Wednesday night. The 1st Battalion came probing my lines shortly after midnight. I had to work quickly because of the danger that the sound of the attack would wake the 2nd Battalion, especially since the 2nd Battalion was sleeping fitfully after a dinner of candy. All that sugar keeps the blood boiling. Candy for dinner, the 2nd Battalion had cheered earlier in the evening when Dad had proposed the usual deal. If you promise to be a big girl and play with the dogs while your dad puts your brother to bed, we'll have candy for dinner. But you must eat all your chocolate-covered peanut butter cups before you get any ice cream. Protein comes first. What do you say? Candy for dinner, she had screamed. And now she tossed uneasily in her bed while I nursed the 1st Battalion back to sleep. The 2nd Battalion attacked about an hour later. My daughter, who will turn 4 on Sunday, is at the age in which children begin having nightmares. When the nightmares began a few months ago, it was always about wolves. Daddy, there's a wolf in my room, she'd say. So I spent a lot of time telling her that wolves aren't so bad. Sure, they always play the heavy in fairy tales, but in real life, wolves are nice. They're like dogs. McClellan's like wolves, I told her. In fact, I spent hours explaining the McClellan philosophy to her. Our ancestors were woodsmen and woodswomen. Wolves and bears and even lions were our friends. Lorna is a sharp little kid, and she caught on to the family philosophy. But still, the nightmares persisted. They simply changed ever so slightly to fit the family philosophy. Wednesday night, she woke up screaming, "Daddy, Daddy, there's a lawyer in my room." I heard her scream and rushed into the room before her shouts would rouse the 1st Battalion. "There's no lawyer in here, honey," I said. To calm her fears, I opened the closet. I looked under her bed. No lawyers anywhere. "Go back to sleep, Lorna, and don't worry. Your dad will stay right here for a while." Unfortunately, her shouts had stirred the 2 company of Viet Cong asleep on the floor. Both dogs began barking. "Daddy, Daddy, there must be a lawyer somewhere. The dogs are barking," Lorna said. The ruckus woke the 1st Battalion. He stood up in his crib and began howling. "Jack sees the lawyer, Daddy," Lorna shouted. Now the battle was raging. The enemy was hitting my lines from all directions. "Calm down, everybody," I shouted into the din, which only caused the noise level to double, then triple. "He's going to sue us, Daddy, I know it," my daughter cried. I left her and rushed over to take care of the 1st Battalion, who was trying to scale the crib. Often the best way to calm a baby is to change its diaper. Even though Jack's diaper was dry, I began to take it off. But in the middle of the task, Jack, well, let me just say I should have waited a minute. "Corman, I'm hit," I screamed. The battle raged for nearly an hour. Finally, the NVA and the Viet Cong ran out of energy and slipped into the night. I returned to bed, exhausted, too tired to sleep. The next day, my wife returned. We all cheered as she walked through the door. "You look terrible," she said to me. "You look like somebody who just ran a marathon." "Wrong fantasy," I said. Oh, okay, let me read one more, and the final one will be about one of the subjects that I often write about, and that's how women are smarter than men, which is something that it took me years and years to come to grips with, because I had one of those sheltered childhoods where when I realized that all the girls did better in class than my friends and I, and my mother tried to protect me and said it's because girls mature faster. And it wasn't really until I was 40 and realized we hadn't caught up that the truth came clear. Anybody who doesn't believe that women are superior to men ought to spend a day at the courthouse, any day. I happened to be at the St. Louis County Courthouse on Monday morning. I was there for a case involving a basketball hoop. It seems that in the normally peaceful environs of West County, residents had installed a basketball pole and hoop on the common grounds of a cul-de-sac. Not everybody liked this impromptu park. My guy, for instance, he objected to it. One morning, as he backed out of his driveway in his truck, he accidentally rammed the pole. He hit it with such force that the pole and the hoop somehow attached themselves to his truck. He did not realize that he was dragging the pole as he left the cul-de-sac and drove down the street. He only realized that he was dragging something after he had turned the corner. Then he got out of his truck and did what any good citizen would do. He pushed the pole and hoop off the side of the road. At least that was his story. The neighbors thought he had done this thing intentionally. Perhaps because one of the neighbors happens to be a chief of police for one of the western municipalities, my guy was charged with felony stealing. The trial was supposed to begin Monday morning. Frankly, I was somewhat skeptical of my guy's story. It sounded to me like he had gotten angry, simmered about it, and then had done a guy thing. While I was in the hallway waiting for his trial to begin, a woman approached me. She had recognized me from the newspaper. "What brings you here?" I asked. "My husband," she said. "Of course. Unless a woman is a lawyer, a courthouse employee, a juror, or a witness, she's usually at the courthouse for her husband or her son. In this case, the woman's husband had been busted for DWI. He was sitting on a bench in the hallway. He had that humble hangdog demeanor that guys get when they've done something bad. Might as well wear a sign, "I'm flawed, but what did you expect? I'm a man." "You'll probably be all right," I told him. "Is this your first?" "It's my fifth," he said. "Could be prison," I said. He said he was hoping for work release. He added that he had quit drinking and was going to meetings a couple times a week, so he could handle any kind of probation, he assured me. He was never going to drink and drive again. His wife, who had surely heard that story before, didn't say anything. They have two kids in grammar school, and now her man, who's probably a good and decent man, was turning the world upside down for a drink. I went back into the courtroom to see if my guy's case was up yet. It wasn't. The judge was accepting a guilty plea. From a guy, of course. This fellow looked to be about 35. He, too, had the hangdog demeanor. He was pleading guilty of having had sex with a 14-year-old. It was consensual, his lawyer later assured me, and the guy had never been in trouble before. But still, the man's wife sat in the second row. She was dressed as if for church, and she did a wonderful job of maintaining her dignity. Expressionless, she watched the proceedings. Her man, I thought to myself, her man. With him it hadn't been booze, but another guy thing. I went out to feed the meter, but stopped abruptly in the lobby. A car was resting inches from the front door. Somebody had jumped the curb and pulled up to the courthouse door. Undoubtedly, this was another guy thing. Indeed, the car belonged to a 46-year-old man who had been in court earlier in the morning. He had been representing himself, the male ego at work. He didn't need an attorney. And he had wanted the judge to order the arrest of his ex-wife. The judge advised him to get a lawyer, so the man decided to make a guy statement. Now he was sitting against the wall, his arms handcuffed behind him. He was wearing a shirt and a tie and an expression of righteousness, which so often precedes the more becoming and natural hangdog look. After feeding the meter, I went back up to the courtroom to discover that the basketball case had been disposed of. My guy had agreed to donate $500 to the Backstoppers, undoubtedly the chief's favorite charity, and write a letter of apology to the neighborhood children. In return, the charges were dropped. Not surprisingly, this sensible deal had been arranged by the prosecutor, who happened to be a woman. As I was leaving the courthouse, I ran into a defense attorney of my acquaintance. "It's flawed guy day in the courthouse," I said. "As always," she said, and then she hurried off to meet her client, who was, no doubt, a man. Thank you.